Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1102.ex1243, certificate number 48606, the Sarajevo Haggada.
Kadesh urchatz karpas yachatz.
When this text was suggested by a Patreon donor named Valerie, she had some other great suggestions, too. I almost went with the Albigensian Crusade.
Oh, that's a good one.
It's fun. Yeah. Sending a crusade to France instead of the Holy Land.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, finally.
Well, think about all the Moors in France.
Finally, we found a real, and it's not even Moors. It's just like slightly heretical Christians in what? I think northern? Yeah, no, southern France, right?
Not Huguenots, but.
Christian farmers that have a slightly wrong idea about the Pope.
How many popes?
Let's wipe them out too. Like, finally we found an enemy that history can agree on, the French.
The problem is that too many crusaders were dying on the, assailing the walls of Acre. And so it was like, you know what? I'm searching for my keys under this streetlight because I can see.
Where could we have a crusade this summer? Oh, how about the Riviera? But I noticed when she suggested the Sarajevo Haggadah, which I had not heard of, I realized, I don't know if there's a, is there Judaica in the Omnibus?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, unless you don't count the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Is there authentic Judaica? So that was the first thing that came to mind, is we've discussed anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, you know, that may come up from time to time, but like, have we discussed actual, in this case, Sephardic Jewish culture? I don't know.
Listen, if the world wants one thing, it is
you and I.
It is a Mormon and like the quintessential Goyisha, talking about, you know, global Judaic.
Should we tiptoe in more? Gently?
Gently?
Like, what if we just start off by doing a show about the movie Private Benjamin?
Okay.
Does that kind of like, you know, get a toe in the water of how you and I might discuss Jewish culture?
You know, I'm constantly putting Goldie Hawn sexy or Goldie Hawn NSFW.
It autocomplete. If you type the word G in your Google, mine goes to Google Earth. Yours goes to Goldie Hawn sexy. Goldie Hawn sexy pictures.
Goldie Hawn sexy pictures. And I have two files on my desktop. So I know all about
Private Benjamin. Because you like to see her in uniform. Do you ever Photoshop her into an Israeli army uniform?
I don't know anything about Photoshop, but I definitely have Israeli military girls as one of my frequent searches too. Because I love those calendars.
You just got back from the Holy Land. I didn't realize you had gone to try to find a soldier wife.
The funny thing is, if you look at popular culture, you would think the streets of Tel Aviv were swarming with teenagers in army uniforms carrying machine guns. It's not true. But if you are
a tiny fraction of the number you wanted.
But if you are driving out in the country, like, the further out in the country you go.
Ken, did I ever tell you when I walked across Israel?
The more likely you are to see, and they're always at bus stops. There's always like one lonely teenage soldier sitting at a bus stop in the middle of the desert around Galilee.
Don't they have a van pool? Don't they have jeeps?
No, they're just out there waiting for the bus. And you're like, is this like your job or are you just on your way to work?
Did you ever start a conversation? Did you want to chat with the bus stop soldiers?
I mean, I definitely was prepared to pull over and pick up hitchhikers, but the machine guns dissuaded me.
I thought that's why you had the calendars.
It is.
You wanted, the machine guns are an important part of the fantasy, I would have assumed.
When I say dissuaded, I don't mean dissuaded.
have you ever been to a Seder?
Yes.
You had friends invite you?
I have been to several Seders, and in fact, one here in Seattle, there used to be an entertainment business Seder that happened here, and I was routinely cast as the Pharaoh.
Because
I was there.
Were you the only Gentile there?
I was the only Gentile. So I would come, and I had a Pharaoh's robe, and then we would play out the Seder story. And I would be the brrr, harumph, harumph.
You could just come over to any dinner and be the Pharaoh, I think.
Pretty much. At my own home, I'm the Pharaoh.
You could put that over.
But yeah, I've been the token goy more than a handful of times around here in Seattle.
I've been invited to Seattle Seders, and I've really enjoyed it. The very first Seder I went to is kind of not a Seder with an asterisk.
I thought you were going to say nautical Seder.
It was nautical, like, yeah.
Whoa.
You could be King Neptune and the Pharaoh.
How did I not get invited to the nautical Seder?
I mean, Pharaoh was not very nautical. Like,
well, yeah.
At the end, right?
tried
to navigate the Red Sea.
His armies proved not very nautical.
Not waterproof.
Naughty, but not nautical.
I think they might call it a Seder simulation now, which sounds like
ChatGPT,
which sounds like a fun video game, right? Would mm-hmm. you play a, would you put on a VR helmet and have a Seder simulation game?
Why is today on, why is tonight unlike other nights?
Yeah, there's four side quests. No, you're not fire. Unless you're Pharaoh, I guess. Are you going to play as Pharaoh?
Yeah,
I guess that's the lowest
hard mode.
That's the lowest. Yeah. Highest difficulty mode. I think it's you versus the ocean. No, there's, this was at, of all places, Provo, Utah. And I spent quite a bit of time yesterday trying to find out how problematic this is.
Okay.
Ever since, I think, the 1970s, there was a BYU professor who put on kind of an exhibition match Seder every year.
Exhibition match?
Well, he's not a rabbi, you know, it's not.
Oh, I see what you mean. I thought you were saying he pitted Jews against.
He found two different synagogues and he said, which of you has the best Seder?
No, I thought it was some really interesting one where it was like, here's a Seder, but we're going to pit Mormons against.
Oh, I see.
So, yeah, because the story goes back, right? It could be alternate universe.
Well, the thing to explain here.
Is Mormonism alternate universe Judaism?
Mormons think so and Jews do not. That's the short answer there. Because here's the thing so to understand why this might be problematic, you have to understand that a lot of Christian megachurches today are holding Seders.
Oh, I understand. I've seen that.
So they do this Jewish ritual, but then they explain how this is all symbols. Everything in the meal is actually a symbol of Jesus. And more to the point, Jesus had a Seder, and let's reenact the Last Supper of our Lord.
It's like in Raiders of the Lost Ark when the French Jewish archaeologist performs the ritual for the Nazis.
Marion, don't look in the Haggadah. When he starts to recite the Haggadah, plug your ears.
So yeah, this is really happening, and I mean, this is part of the apocalyptic Christianity, right?
I mean, like, it overlaps with that idea.
Bring the end times.
Well, they're not thinking God will smite us down for doing the Seder.
But
they are thinking that Jewish culture is just kind of a beta version of Christianity, and therefore we should be able to download it for free.
but correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't there some kind of, there's just a tone of it that feels like a conjuring act, right? Like, we want the Messiah to come back, and the Messiah's only going to come back to the Holy Land if
there's a certain number of... prophecies of wars and rumors of wars in the Book of Revelation. So
they're already speaking Hebrew there.
The quicker you can get to a big military escalation in the Middle East, the better.
But it does feel like we're going to conjure the Messiah with our secret tricks and like special program, right? Which seems kind of not very Christian.
Well, it seems Hitler adjacent.
And also a little bit pagan. Like, are you... Like, when was the last time someone conjured a god? I mean, you know, not counting the Wiccan ceremonies that are happening
voodoo,
here
does voodoo
in Seattle.
Count?
Yeah, I guess. No, that's not. Those aren't gods. Those are
Loa. Yeah. They're spirits. The Seder is adjacent to that kind of evangelical Christian tradition, but it's just, I mean, they think of it as a harmless interpretation of they're putting their own spin on the Seder, and you know, to a Jewish audience, it's all bound up with the centuries of anti-Semitism and blood libel, and the idea that the Jews are morally responsible for killing Christ. So to take one of their ancient rituals and turn it into Christology, it rubs people the wrong way.
I wonder. I was in the West Bank and I bought a keftia because my sister.
It's the Arafat headdress,
which, you know, it's a traditional garment, but not a traditional garment that was imbued with any.
Are you appropriating Arafat?
Well, here's the thing. It was not prior to Arafat. Really, it was just a headscarf that farmers wore.
Keeps the sun off you.
And then Arafat started wearing it because it connected him to the farmer culture, right? It was like, I'm a rural guy.
And when asked, he would say that he actually tied it in a particular shape of the Palestinian homeland.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a map.
It draped down as Palestine.
If you saw him from behind or above or something.
And so for a while, the keftia was a symbol of support for Palestinians. So you would see it on college campuses in the 80s here in the States and in Europe, and it was like, yeah, I stand with the Palestinians. But then, of course, it got appropriated as just a fashion statement, and you would see it all the time. That pattern or those scarves just used in the spring collection of
Or in your catalog, Kmart. Where there's a different Bader Meinhof girl for every month of the year.
Exactly.
You put it up next to your...
Bader Meinhof girls.
Put it up next to your IDF calendar.
Why is there not a song called Bader Meinhof girls? I'm going to write it. But now... The Palestinians seem to be a little bit reticent about people buying keftia as like.
Is the idea that it is cultural appropriation?
Well, now it has become, although really Arafat was culturally appropriating this farmer hat and farmer scarf,
and probably tried to export it. He was probably delighted.
Yeah. Now it's made the whole transition all the way to like, well, we don't really want to sell these to you. But in this case, we'll sell it to you, John, because you seem righteous.
It's even more troublesome in Mormon circles in some ways because, you know, Mormons are not just
handsome.
Christian, handsome, toothy,
elven
Westerners.
Uh-huh.
No, they have their own exodus. You know, the symbolism of the Seder is very meaningful to a Mormon audience because, you know, instead of being in... You know, we were in slavery in Egypt and wound up in Salt Lake City. Is that better?
Mm. It's a movement of Jah people.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, a Mormon audience tends to identify with specific imagery in the Seder if you ask a Mormon, it's very easy to find someone who will be like, oh, yeah, sure. You know, I feel like I really grok Judaism. And
you're talking about the Mormon exodus from
Illinois.
From Ohio.
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, I'm trying to piece together
this. Our Egypt is Illinois. Our Moses is Brigham Young. Our desert would be the Rockies. I guess.
Yeah,
our Mount Sinai is
the plains. But who was the Pharaoh?
Governor Lilburn Boggs,
there you go.
Of Missouri, who signed the original extermination order
before he was
mysteriously killed, possibly by Mormon assassins. Is that should we get into blood libel?
Thrown down a well.
Who knows what happened to that guy? But so ever since the 1970s, it's become this campus tradition on BYU that you go to this simulated Seder.
I had no idea. You are giving away some of the protocols of the elders of
the elders of
Mormon
the elders of Provo, the elders of Zion National Park.
Yeah.
And this is a ticket you got to get months in advance because it's such a hot ticket item that you would want to do take a date to a fake BYU Seder every Passover.
And are the Seder? I mean, the Seders I've been to pretty fun.
That's the idea.
I see.
You know, it's a meal with a floor show. You got to admire a good Seder because, you know, even at the nicest molecular gastronomy restaurants, there's no arc really.
Yeah, that's right. There's no Pharaoh.
Seder's got plot. It's got a villain. A side quest is invented to keep the kids interested. You got to hide the Afikoman, and everything you eat is imbued with a symbol that is explained to you. There's musical interludes.
I just wish the food was all tastier.
Yeah.
A lot of crackers.
You know what I like? You know what I like in my bread? Leavening. When I eat a piece of bread, I'm like, man, I'm so glad this is leavened.
Yeah.
But that's the point. You got to.
Yeah, that's the problem.
The meal helps you remember. Like most of the year, we get to eat better bread than this. So, you know, I went to one of these and I searched in vain for someone complaining about this.
You went to it when you were in college? Or?
I did. And since I've been to actual seders with Jewish friends, but this was my first exposure to the liturgy. And I was able to find articles in, not the Jerusalem Post, but what's the Jewish American newspaper? You know, in whatever that politically independent newspaper is, and then in Forward, which is kind of the progressive Jewish paper covering, you know, this, but they kind of treated it as a delightful novelty. Like,
do they?
Yeah, we're here in Provo, and
are you talking about this?
A Seder demonstration is a hot ticket.
A Sentinel?
Not this. That one seems maybe conservative by the name.
Oh, the Advocate.
No, that's the gay one. Unless there is there one called the?
There's the Jewish Advocate.
I bet that's what it is. Unless that's the gay Jewish paper.
I don't know. I think all of them are gay Jewish papers.
That's your conspiracy theory? You don't even have to say newspaper anymore. I know. Yeah,
I know what that means.
I know who's publishing that. But it seems like even though the megachurch guys are getting roasted over the coals for this, it seems like the Mormons have gotten off scot-free.
That's how the Mormons get you.
Because they're, yeah.
They seem cute. Yeah. They seem cute and harmless and charming.
Look at this little fun thing they're doing with their big Osmond smiles up there in the mountains.
As long as they stay up there by that lake, like trapped between the lake and the mountains, what harm can they cause?
How could they bother anyone? I mentioned that Seders have an ark, and this is always contained in a text called a Haggadah from the Jewish chattel. It's just a word meaning telling, but the word I think is not used to mean any tale or story. It's specifically the tale of the Exodus.
And, this tale.
Yeah, and a Haggadah.
Why is this tale unlike other tales?
It's very unlike other tales, John. you can't get around that. And so the dramatic beats of a Seder meal that you expect are contained in these Haggadah, you know, from the breaking of the matzah all the way through to the end of the meal. And they are, they date back to the third or fourth century, which means this Christian tradition of Jesus doing a Seder the night before his arrest is, because the gospel specifies Passover meal.
Yeah.
So I think your modern observer will assume it's a Seder, and that may not be true. There's no evidence that Second Temple Jews were doing anything like the modern Seder narrative in their Passover meal.
So, wait a minute. The Torah dates back to 400 BC.
Sure. No, they would have had the account of the Exodus.
Yeah, but
the idea that they're doing the bitter herbs and then they're explaining the questions and hiding the matzah and
but so all of this
Elijah's
was,
cup.
Was it actually trying to make the religion cool and new for kids in the face of Christianity?
I mean,
like taking all the energy out of the room?
I mean, it may be an attempt to modernize. Yeah. It's the equivalent of a cool youth pastor.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, hey, kids.
Hey, you know what
if I gave you? What if I gave you some bitter herbs? They don't taste good, do they? Well, you know what else doesn't taste good? Building pyramids.
Yeah, that's right.
You know who else didn't like to build pyramids? Moses.
I mean, I can kind of see the moment, right? Christianity's got all the momentum. The Jews are like, how do we modernize this story and make it, you know, like set it to a rap beat.
And it's hard to say because they're, you know, probably oral traditions predate our first written account that this is a ritual meal that takes place on the 14th night of the first month or, you know, it's a lunar calendar, so it's tricky.
But the fact that it was an oral tradition didn't keep any of these other books from being written, right?
We still have a lot of those other oral traditions. So yeah, when we don't have any evidence before the third or the fourth centuries, to me, it seems pretty compelling that you know, Jesus and his disciples just, you know, had a nice piece of lamb and called it good. Like that's what the Pesach dinner was.
I mean, it's also possible
at the Second Temple time.
The whole thing is made up.
The Exodus?
No, the dinner.
I see. The Exodus is real, but Jesus never had dinner.
The Exodus is, yeah. The parting of the Red Sea clearly is journalistic documentation of a thing that happened.
And obviously, Jesus is real. You're saying he wasn't hungry that
Jesus
night.
Jesus is real. I'm sure he was hungry.
He didn't want to nosh.
I'm sure he had some food, but did they sit at a long table? Did
How come nobody's on the other side of the table?
Yeah, what the hell? Is it a dais at the front of a big convention center?
Can you imagine the maitre d'? It's like, we need a table for 24. But sir, there's only 13 in your party. I said 24. And we just want Stillwater. You know, this guy will take care of that. We don't want to see the wine list.
When I was dating a millennium for a while, millennium girlfriend, some listeners will recognize. And she was one of those, let's sit next to each other in a booth people. Yeah. And the first time we went out to a restaurant and I sat down and she sat down next to me, I was like, no.
Are you pranking me? Why are you in my space?
We are not sitting next to each other in a booth, people. We are not matching velour tracksuits, people, either. Get over to your side.
Mindy's college roommate, Crystal, was famous for this. We would talk at length about how Crystal and her boyfriend were always at the same side of the booth.
No. I mean, I don't mean to yuck anybody's yum if you're listening and like, I'm that kind, but I am not that kind. But I'm wondering if Jesus and his disciples were all like, let's all sit on one side of the booth.
Like, this is like, we all get along. Like, it would be too distant to put six of you over there.
Wait, you know what it was? The other side of the table were all the women. And they got X'd out of the history.
That's exactly. The herstory.
The herstory. All the female disciples were on the other side of the table.
Honestly, it's the sitcom reason why nobody sits on the other side of the table. It would block Leonardo da Vinci's view of the apostles. It's,
right, there you go.
But, so that's the bummer of the reason. Boom, boom. We went to, it was our anniversary. No, it wasn't our anniversary. It was my birthday. It was my birthday.
Yours and mine?
Yeah. It was our anniversary, John. Uh-huh. Where should we go for dinner?
Oh, gosh, I missed it.
For my birthday dinner last week, we went out to the fancy restaurant in Woodinville. Have you ever been to the fancy restaurant in Woodinville?
No, I avoid Woodinville at all costs.
The one that's been there for 30 years.
No, I'll drive all the way around rather than go.
It's the French Laundry of Seattle. Yep. And
I've driven past it.
It was salmon night, unbeknownst to us, which meant 13 courses of salmon.
No, thanks.
There was salmon in everything but the bread and the dessert.
Oh, no, thanks.
And
one salmon course.
But what we found out there was pretty much all the tables are four tops. But if you book it as a party of two, which pretty much everyone had, like the majority of the people sitting there were parties of two. They just put you on the banquette next to each other, like Millennium Girlfriend. So you missed your chance.
It's
to
like,
take her to Herb Farm.
It's like eating dinner on an Amtrak. Have you taken a cross country Amtrak? You cannot. Yeah. If you go into the dining room, they're gonna put you with strangers who are weirdos. Because who else is on a cross-country Amtrak?
Well, I've seen Hitchcock movies. Like,
weirdos.
Is that not how you meet Eva Marie Saint?
It is, if you're lucky.
But in real life, no.
No, it's how you meet a couple of Mennonites that are just going from one town to the next.
Even though the Haggadah probably goes back to the 3rd or 4th centuries, we don't have actual standalone, full printed illuminated Haggadahs until the 13th or 14th century.
Okay.
You know, there's mentions in other, here are the, a prayer collection will be like, here are the prayers you say over the Pesach meal, or there will be a mention of somebody doing a Seder. But we don't have like, here's your standalone booklet.
Maybe this is stuff that came back from the Crusades, right? It lines up time-wise.
Well, it's all happening in Spain, which until Ferdinand and Isabella kick out the Jews, boo, in 1492.
Boo, 1492. Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
So many bad things happened.
Boo.
So many unwoke things happened in 1492, John. I'm going to do a 1491 project that's all about a cool multicultural Spain.
There you go.
Because it really kind of was. Like, Jews and Muslims and Christians, like, actually lived in the society. And I'm sure there were hierarchies and rivalries and prejudices.
Dogs and cats sleeping together.
But it was a cultural melting pot.
Well, that was true of a lot of the Ottoman Empire. They were pretty good at as long as you paid your taxes.
That's what we're going to get to. We're getting to the Ottomans. You're exactly right. And so a lot of these Haggadahs come from this period. There's a Barcelona Haggadah. There's the Washington Haggadah, which in fact was not drawn by monks in Spokane or even the Beltway. But it's just, it's in a Washington museum now.
I see.
It's a Spanish
like
Sephardic. Exactly.
You didn't write it.
But today we're talking about the Sarajevo Haggadah, mostly because of its interesting modern history, but it's a one of a kind text of itself. If you can picture, it's about 6 by 9 inches. It's not that big.
Nope, that's not that big.
It's a vellum codex. This is all, when did we talk about vellum? You did a show about, I don't even remember.
It was...
there was a very parchment heavy omnibus at some point.
Yeah, it was one of the great omnibus.
And even while you were doing it, I probably couldn't remember the topic.
Yeah, let's see. It was. We talked about it a lot and it was
much
amazing.
Much less now, months later.
And we are experts on it.
No one knew, there's no historical record of the Sarajevo Haggadah until 1894. When it's acquired, speaking of the Ottomans, by the Bosnian National Museum.
I remember this was the book that we have never translated.
Oh, right. The
Voynich manuscript.
There you go.
It's in there.
That is correct. We have control of the board, John.
We have 200 listeners right now who are screaming at their headphones.
It's Voynich manuscript. It's
Voynich manuscript. Their spouse or partner was in the other room going, what?
It's a really good test. We know a lot of these people have issues with depression or anxiety, and we're glad we gave you this little moment to...
to be superior to us. But we got there.
Yeah, if you have depression, you can feel superior to us. If you have anxiety, it was really a chance to work out some of those feelings you get when something frustrating is happening to you.
Hyperventilating a little.
You're welcome. You can tell your therapist you had a good session with us this week.
So this is a manuscript that only appeared in the late 19th century,
but we know goes back to pre-Inquisition Spain.
Okay.
And it's interesting.
Through radiocarmid testing?
Well, yeah, mostly through cultural clues on the manuscript. For example, you can see it's suspected that it's a marriage gift, a wedding gift, because it's got the crests of two different Spanish Sephardic Jewish houses.
Okay, cool.
That are coming together there. We can tell it was actually used, we'll see that it's a beautiful piece, but it was actually used for Seder dinners. It's got wine stains on it. So don't throw away your cookbook that got burned on the stove burner or your copy of Catch-22 that has all of your college underlinings in it. You know, that's what history wants.
Because 900 years later, somebody's like, it was in Ken Jennings's hands.
Yeah, it'll be there will be obviously thousands of my bones on display in cathedrals.
In 1898, all of this would have been evidence that it was older, but now has science confirmed that it's old?
I mean, it's clearly not I'm not sure if they've ever done radiocarbon dating on it.
How is this not the Hitler diaries of 1896?
Well, you know, there's no discussion that it's fake, but it was actually a brain-breaking thing when it came up, because at the time it was discovered, Jewish itinerant family named Cohen, coming from Venice to the Balkans, sells it to the Bosnian National Museum in the 1890s. At this time, it was believed that Jewish medieval art would never have had figurative art.
Oh.
In accordance with...
Sure.
With
the Quran.
Of course, with the Quran. Yeah. The second commandment, which one says no graven images? The second, right?
Yeah.
So the idea is if you're not supposed to make graven images, that would include, you know, it's the Islamic prohibition against.
But was that mainstream Judaism? Because, you know, that for every interpretation, there is an equal and opposite interpretation.
And that's what was not clear. And now it's clear that, you know, Talmudic scholars in 1400s Spain or 1300s Spain would not have blinked at this because you see depictions of, in fact, you see people sitting at a Seder table. One of the most interesting facts, these are beautiful illustrations, by the way, they are, they're in a style that would have, you know, since we don't know what Jewish medieval art looks like, this was the case. It kind of looks like just a medieval prayer book. It looks like a Christian prayer book with that style of art. But then there's some kind of Arabic influence, Moorish influence design elements in the calligraphy. The oddest element is there's a black woman sitting at a Seder table. She's clearly got African coded features. She's got just jet dark skin.
She's from the Ethiopian tribes.
She's breaking a matzah.
Although if she's jet black, well, you know, pen technology.
Exactly.
Paint technology at the time.
Exactly. So it's not clear why there's a black woman breaking matzah.
Oh, it's a lost tribe of Israel. Would have known, right?
Now we know.
Yeah.
Didn't we do a show about this?
The lost tribes of Israel? No.
No.
I would remember.
Basically 20th century black repurposing of Judaism.
Yes.
Like,
we didn't do a whole show. Oh boy, we should do Black Jesus. Talk about dancing around the minefield.
This.
Who should do that show? You.
I'll do Black Jesus. Thank you. Who could be better qualified? You know, it's amazing that this existed, because after the Alhambra decree kicked all the Jews out of Spain, it actually became criminal to even possess Judaica. Like, a lot of these people fled to Portugal, and Portugal passed laws saying, hey, if we catch you with a Torah.
Yeah, but there were whole communities of people who retained their Judaism under secret cover.
Sure. You know, these things did survive, and this one apparently survived by making it to Venice, which at the time was a
free city,
right? Mercantile hub. Yeah, cosmopolitan. It was his own city. And, you know, I'm not saying it was super enlightened. They had a Jewish ghetto, but a very, you know, prosperous and bustling one, welcoming all comers. You
That's
know,
how they get you.
As long as, well, I mean, that is how they get you. it's not hypothetical at all. But in this case, there were very strict laws on what a Jewish person could say, or particularly print, you know, so there were censorship laws. And the list is hilarious. It's like, a Jew cannot be described as devout.
No.
Because that would imply...
They're some of the most devout.
Exactly. But, you know, but by their thinking, you know, a modern pluralistic thinking, of course, you can say a devout Jew, but, you know, right. That would imply that a Jew is devoted to God. And of course, a Jew misunderstands our Lord and could not be devoted to God, you know? So all these little minefields, but we know that this codex was past censorship, because it actually has a stamp in 1609 from the priest who was in charge of...
In Venice.
Yeah, the Venetian priest, Catholic priest, who was in charge of saying, okay, you guys can keep this Torah or whatever. And it says, revisto per me, you know, clunk. It's got a Latin signet below the wedding things.
I wonder if that's just a cool Venetian bro who's like, yeah, bros, you can keep your cool book.
I mean, maybe it's kind of a modern... pluralistic secular society where even the priest is like, yeah, I get it. I got to do this. But
or it could have also been like, you and your primitivism are no threat to our.
Or it could have been he was paid off, or it could have been this actually was the less offensive of all the books he did burn.
I'm gonna think
you think
he was cool. I'm gonna think it was a cool dude.
This is because he went to Gonzaga. You're heavily invested in thinking that. All Catholic priests in the 17th century were like, you're cool Jesuits.
It was 17th century. Oh, so it could
1609.
Have been a, could have been a cool Jesuit.
The book is beautiful, although the Austro-Hungarians did a number on it. It's you know, it's got gold and silver leaf. The pigments are crushed precious stones, so it's malachite and lapis. And
that's cool.
I mean, it had to be insured in the 90s to travel to an exhibition, and it was valued then at $7 million. But really, it's priceless. It's one of the one or two oldest Haggadahs, and it's gorgeous, and
Have you ever been to a Judaica store? In Manhattan, there's a whole sort of neighborhood where there are stores that sell antique or, you know, kind of even older, like... items and elements of Jewish culture, and they're incredible to visit. I haven't been to one in many years, but I used to wander in and kind of, you know, I sort of want that stuff. It's some of it is so beautiful.
That's appropriation.
But it would be dumb for me to
maybe take off your keffiyeh or whatever before you go in.
Yeah, maybe so. I don't know. I don't know what place a menorah would have in my decorative style. Maybe if I put some fishing net on it so it looked more northwestern.
Does that make it better or worse if you jazz it up?
If you put fishing net on it, I could plausibly say like, no, it's a King Neptune.
I mean, is it worse to get a menorah and be like, yeah, no, I feel a deep kinship with the Jewish people and I light this every Hanukkah? Is that better or worse than like, no, I put these candles made of. Whatever kind of weird. What are your weird indie rock candles, John?
I actually have a set of candles that are made out of Prudhoe Bay crude oil, and they're black. The candles are black.
Valdez candles.
They're Valdez candles, and they are extremely. I've never lit them. They're beautiful.
Well, I don't think they would smell good.
I don't think they would.
They're going to make
either.
Your house smell like a gas station.
Maybe
right?
That's why I haven't. I've never set them on fire.
I think you were smart. Maybe when you need to do some voodoo ritual at some point, maybe that's the way to go. John, should we read an ad for Squarespace?
You know, I like to read ads for Squarespace because I'm so impressed with their product.
Yeah, that's what it says in front of you to say. I get it. I like where you're going with this.
A lot of ads for companies I won't mention, like, for instance, Hitler. I don't like reading ads for Hitler. I'm like, oh, do I have to? But Squarespace, I'm like, yeah, thumbs up.
The question at this point is, will Squarespace pass for an ad in which you mentioned Adolf Hitler 10 seconds in?
I bet they will.
Because you were on the right side of it. You said you didn't want to read an ad for him.
Squarespace, better than Hitler.
Whereas you do love their all-in-one platform for building brands and growing businesses online. Right?
I do. I mean, I make stuff. I do stuff. I sell stuff. And what I need are the tools to get e-commerce templates, for instance, inventory management, a simple checkout process. I mean, I'm not very smart, Ken.
You're not going to sit at home doing your own, writing your own inventory management software.
No.
I mean, most people would, but John is lazy.
It's hard enough for me to even turn on this this stuff, let alone like make it work.
So most people would sit home designing their own web templates, writing their own e-commerce software, writing maybe a separate appointment scheduling app. But if you are one of the lazy people like John who does not want to write all that software from the ground up.
And I'm guessing you are, given that you're listening to this show.
Can we recommend Squarespace?
Wait a minute. You might be listening for Ken. You might be one of these detail-oriented people that's writing software right now to silence me.
Do you think most people listening to this have already written their own appointment scheduling app for their website?
No. I'm talking to the ones that haven't, that still need appointment scheduling. Go to squarespace.com/omnibus for a free trial of the Squarespace softwares.
When you're ready to launch, you can use offer code Omnibus, and that will save you 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Guess what? You can add online booking and scheduling to your Squarespace site. Clients can see your availability and even reschedule. This is your opportunity to be lazy like me and still get things done. Go to squarespace.com/omnibus.
So, you know, you mentioned these stores selling antique Judaic. Obviously, things took a turn for that market in the 1930s and 40s in Europe, which is where the story of the Sarajevo Haggada takes a turn. Now it survives. You can go to the Bosnian National Museum has had some funding problems of late, but I think as at the time of this recording, it is on display in a beautiful climate-controlled vault. Bosnia has added it to the UNESCO Memory of the World Register of you know, its best and most important historical items. It's the crown jewel of the museum's collection. But it barely survived the 1940s. And I mean, it barely survived Austria-Hungary. It's no longer as we don't know what the original covers look like, because when it turned up in the 1890s, it was immediately shipped off to Vienna for study, because
that's what you do.
Bosnia was then part of the Austrian Empire, and for whatever reason, they just decided, oh, we'll put a cool new binding on this. They just, you know, knifed out every page and put it in a new cardboard binding with these anachronistic kind of Turkish-looking covers. So we don't have any information about what it originally looked like then.
Kidding.
But the real indignities came is beginning in 1941 when the Nazis occupied Croatia and absorbed Bosnia and Sarajevo into their new fascist puppet state. And immediately, you know, the as you mentioned, the Ottoman Empire, you know, the Balkans having been kind of a crossroads for lots of different cultures. A lot of these Balkan cities had big, you know, prosperous Jewish populations. And immediately they felt the pinch of the Nazis moving in. Synagogues were sacked and Torah scrolls were burned in the streets. And quickly, the ethnic cleansing began. But interestingly, because it's being conducted by Croatians, it's now Jews and Serbs that are getting taken off to labor camps, labor in quotes, because these were not really, they were not interested in a labor force.
Well, that's before Mallory and Miller parachuted in with their briefcase full of exploding poop.
I don't think I know the story. We need to do this in the omnibus. Is this a...
It's the plot of Force 10 from Navarone.
Wait. Not even Guns of Navarone. Force 10
Force
from Navarone.
Force 10 from Navarone. Starring...
Harrison Ford.
There you go.
Do you think when Harrison Ford is just a purely AI creation, they will make a Force 11 and Force 12 from Navarone?
Yeah, well, you know, they still have Carl Weathers in the Star Wars greater universe, right? Because he was in Force 10 from Navarone.
Wait, he was?
He was the...
That's a very early Carl Weathers appearance. He's probably still on an offensive line somewhere when he's making that.
Yeah, and he was like kind of the accidental star of the movie. And now, of course, he's in Mando. So Carl Weathers, he goes...
Are you saying
you can AI a young one? You can AI an old one?
Are you saying when they have him meet Han Solo, I can't remember his character name, but when they have him meet Han Solo, you think they should reference Force 10 from Navarone?
You're talking about in the Star Wars movies of the future?
Yeah.
If they make a little side reference to like Chetniks.
To exploding poop?
You know, in Star Wars, you could call anything, right? So you could just say, oh yeah, here come the Chetniks.
It was, you know, George Lucas famously just gave everything the laziest name imaginable.
Yeah. Here's the meanies.
This guy's name is Bubo Lubo Dubo. So things are rough, if you're Jewish or Serbian, for that matter, mm-hmm. in Sarajevo still. In 1941, and possibly, possibly hasn't changed much. Now, since 1906, now you mentioned kind of what happened to all this Judaica, the Nazis are not destroying everything.
Yeah, Goering takes it all back to his underground bunker because he thinks it's pretty.
He doesn't just want to melt it down, and I don't know if, you know, our modern mythology is that Hitler wants to use all this Judaica to make a giant laser to blow up tanks or something.
He misunderstands how God feels, I think, a lot. One of Hitler's primary misunderstandings.
I mean, his main misconception is that God loves the Third Reich. I mean, he really shouldn't have started Mein Kampf. First off, God loves Nazis. as we all agree.
Yes.
But you know, I think all that kind of 20th century, I mean, Hitler was a cultist, but the reason why this stuff was getting collected was not so he could make a giant space laser. He, had been lobbied by the Prague Jewish Museum, which had been founded in 1906. It had an amazing collection of historic Jewish artifacts, and its curator, a Jewish man named Karl Stein, saw the writing on the wall when the Nazis rolled into Prague, and
it said Nazis go home.
Yeah, the writing on the wall said Nazis go home. No, he knew that his collection was doomed, and so he decided to work with them. Sometimes you got to work within the system to change the system.
Okay,
he began lobbying his local SS Oberkommandant, and then started to work his way up to the Nazi high command, saying, "We need to save all this stuff. You know, it's in the Nazis' interest to keep a historical record of how they dealt with what was then."
Wouldn't that have been Reinhard Heydrich?
The Jewish, yeah, it was Heydrich. You know,
oh, it was.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, okay. It's some of the worst Nazis, but it actually gets all the way up to the high command and Hitler.
Oh, yeah.
And Hitler eventually approves this idea that we should be confiscating instead of destroying.
Hitler all approves this.
A Hitler-approved plan.
To confiscate it rather than destroy it.
Yes, and the idea is that it can all go in the collections of the Prague Jewish Museum, which will be an invaluable treasure trove when someday there is a world without Jews.
Oh, it's like a archaeological, weird.
It's awful to think of. Now, Hitler is already planning for this parallel future where instead of being largely successful in uprooting the Jews of Europe, he is completely successful. And then if you think about it, there will have to be a new academic study, Judenforschung ohne Juden, Jewish studies, but without Jews.
Jewish studies without Jews.
So you want to create a historical museum that it's just chilling to think about. In the same way today we study extinct dinosaurs by putting them in museums, or we study ancient Egyptians that are not around anymore by looking at their sarcophagi, you're going to be able to go to a museum and see the once mighty Jewish people before we took care of that.
Huh.
And you know, this is, you know, largely the idea that Hitler had this master plan to create this museum is kind of the popular version of the story. And I think it was a rumor that circulated even then that that's why they're keeping this stuff. But largely it was like this museum curator just trying to keep his collection from getting, melted down.
And he was Jewish.
Yeah. Karl Stein was Jewish, but he is successful in persuading the Nazis that maybe they should have this kind of colonial Williamsburg someday, where you go and you see, you know, someday he's telling the Jewish, the Nazi officials, someday you'll go to this museum and a bunch of, you know, Aryan Czechs will be dressed up as Jews in kind of colonial Williamsburg fashion, and you'll see them
churning butter,
going about their day and saying those silly prayers that we've now outlawed. And
what was
it's
he
just chilling?
Was he making a case that they should keep him around to authenticate and curate this stuff?
I mean, generally that's part of all these survival stories. You know, anybody would, I'll.
Let me tell you the difference between this manuscript and that. You need to keep me at least in a windowless room.
I mean,
somewhere.
It's just the desperation of it. Even in the camps, people were willing to be in the work squad that cleaned out the gas chambers.
Although I would never say that was his primary motivation, because it sounds like if I ran a museum, my impulse would be to save the collection,
exactly.
Even at the expense
exactly.
of my own life.
And we see this happen multiple times in this story. So anyway, by the time that the mid-1940s roll around, the Nazis end up, they've confiscated 30,000 items of Judaic, everything from beautiful silk Torah scrolls and candelabra, you know, all this ritual stuff, all the way down to just kind of household kitchenwares, with the idea that someday you're going to go in this museum and see, this is what a Jewish kitchen looked like. So you even had housewares, you know, an IKEA, essentially.
Oh, you know what it would have been? It would have been kosher plates, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Because there were Jewish specific kitchenware.
I was like, what's a Jewish spoon look like? It just looks like a spoon. Oh, wait.
Why is this ladle different from all other ladles?
There would have been separate plates and silver.
But as the Nazis roll into Sarajevo, of course, it's already well known that this priceless Haggadah is sitting in the Bosnian National Museum, which really worries.
Museum worries.
It worries the curator of the museum, one Dervish Korkut. Mm-hmm. I might be pronouncing this wrong. Dervish is a Muslim. In fact, he's a prominent Islamic scholar. He comes from a respected, venerated family of Alim, basically Muslim aristocracy at the time. A lot of his family members are judges of Islamic law. You know, they've got these clerical positions. His brother did the first good translation of the Quran into Serbo-Croatian, which I love because it implies that there have been a number of shitty Serbo-Croatian translations of the Quran, but not this one. But Dervish is a cosmopolitan. He's an intellectual. He speaks 10 languages. At one point, he led the kingdom of Yugoslavia's, you know, he's a cabinet-level officer, Ministry of Religious Affairs or whatever. But he's a modern man. He's wearing, in photographs, he's wearing a neat suit and a fez, of course.
It's easy to forget that more than half the population of Bosnia is Muslim.
It's what, half and half today? It's half Muslim, half Christian today?
But I think at its highest point, it was largely Muslim, 70%.
Yeah. Right. And at the time, a large Jewish minority as well. But, you know, there were, I guess, kind of rampant fascist movements among young Muslims at the time. And Korkut was absolutely dead set against them. He, you know, not just for political reasons, he was actually for scholarly reasons. He had long been interested in kind of Bosnia as a melting pot and all the different, even though it was a majority Muslim country, all the different minority art forms, the Jewish and the Christian cultural traditions, and how they had kind of, you know, intertwined in a place like that. Our man was a pluralist in a fez, and as a result, you know, the Sarajevo Haggadah, with its mix of Jewish and Christian and Islamic traditions in the, you know, just in the art and the culture of it, fascinated him. And so in 1942, when the infamous General Fortner arrives at the museum, he knows that he's here for the Haggadah. Fortner is a true villain. There's not a lot of good Germans in this story. We've already had Heydrich, and now we've got this guy who ran some totally vicious, basically the Black Legion, who had done all these infamous, you know, had allied with the Croatian fascists and done all these infamous atrocities as the Nazis took the Balkans. And he was hanged in 1949, spoilers.
Where are the good Germans in this story?
The Nazis do not win the war. They are not pictured. Mr. Not appearing in this picture.
You know, when the Sephardim were exiled from Spain, a lot of them went to the Balkans, right? This would have been a huge population prior to the war, a massive diaspora.
Yeah, no, it's a lively community in Sarajevo until, I guess, the Nazis get through with it. So General Fortner is here for the Haggadah, and the curator, Dervish Korkut, and the museum director go up and say, what are we going to do with this? He's here. He's obviously here for this book. And Quarka, not having a better idea, slides it down his pants.
Okay.
And, hiding it in the waistband of his trousers. You know, if you've ever snuck candy into a movie, you know the move.
And he replaces it with what? Sleight of hand, he replaces it with an English translation. No, he replaces it with the Serbo-Croatian translation of the Quran. How's the Nazi even going to know?
There are multiple stories of what he does. He actually walks into the meeting after making sure it does not affect the line of his suit.
Mm-hmm.
He walks into the meeting with General Fortner with the Haggadah concealed about his midsection.
Does he put a cucumber wrapped in foil?
And General Fortner, after some pleasantries, General Fortner, and I think Corkett maybe is translating for the director who does not speak. I don't know what the third language is, but he's translating.
Well, it would have been German because there would have been enough Austro-Hungarian,
I guess, yeah,
people there still.
I guess that's probably right. Fortner's, and we don't think of Fortner as a intellectual who's going to switch to English or anything. So they finally get down to business, and Fortner says, "Look, give us your fancy Jewish book. We're going to confiscate it.
Give us this day your daily fancy book."
And Corkett kind of just blinks, what do you do? Like, that's a tricky situation. This guy ran the Black Legion.
Yeah.
Corkett kind of blinks at him and says, "What do you mean?" And he's like, I've come for your book. I've heard of it. And he says, but we gave that to the other Nazis last week.
Oh, the other Nazi ploy.
That's pretty good, right?
Uh-huh.
That's pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And Fortner says, he just starts sputtering, who did you give it to? And Corkett says, "Well, sir, I didn't think it was my place to ask for their papers."
Oh.
So, I'm such a good,
sure,
I'm such a good local that I didn't even blink. I just did what I was told. And so Fortner, unable to do anything, leaves in a huff. But now they got to hide the thing.
Yeah.
And there have been different rumors over the years about what happened. There's, ironic ones where he just hides it in,
in the curtains or in a bookshelf.
Like, yeah, exactly. Hides it in the collection of the museum, right. Where's the better place to hide a, what's the expression? There's an expression here. Where better to hide a, than in a, a trove of,
Yeah. Where better to hide a stick of butter than in a
cow,
right? Please, in a bucket of butter.
Please send your suggestions about what this metaphor is or should be, because I don't know. There's a more glamorous one where he ends up sliding down a drain pipe out a window in order to secret it away. In 2007, no less than the Pulitzer-winning novelist Geraldine Brooks, Pulitzer?
No, National Book Award, then.
Is actually writing an article about this for The New Yorker, and she tracks down some of Corkett's descendants, a great niece or nephew or something who's now at Columbia or Dartmouth, and asks what the, what really did happen during the war. He's like, "Oh, I don't know, but why aren't you asking his widow?" And that's when she discovers in 2007 that Corkett's wife, he had married a much younger woman, was still alive. Flies to Europe to talk to her, and she remembers this. She's like, "Yeah, he brought it home that day, and we just sat over tea staring at this thinking, what do we do?
Put it in the cookie
with
jar.
With this priceless book."
But Nazis never look in the cookie jar.
Do you think that's true? I think they would look in the cookie jar first.
Oh, they get caught with their hands in the cookie jar.
This is just stuff from Force 10 from Navarone, and it may not be factually correct. You're giving advice to the future that comes from a movie I've only seen on VHS tape once.
Miller filled the cookie jar with exploding cookies. That was one of the gags.
They decide to get it out of Sarajevo. The countryside is safer, so he heads up into the mountains south of Sarajevo and gives it to a friend of his who's an imam. And it is hidden in a mosque for the rest of the war.
Clever.
This priceless Jewish manuscript is hidden in a mosque. So you can kind of see why a 2007 New Yorker article is just
loving this.
It's just loving this kind of multicultural peace in the Middle East vibe. Now, this wasn't the, it was returned to the museum after the war, but of course that was not the beginning that was not the end of the Bosnian National Museum's troubles with war.
So it just wrote out the war.
It wrote out the war in a mosque.
Well done, book.
And there's an interesting footnote to that I'll get to in a second. But, if you fast forward to the 90s, the museum's getting shelled again, and eventually it's looted. At one point, police come in after a particularly bad raid, and they find the Sarajevo Haggadah just lying face down on the floor. Whoever had looted the museum had not realized that they were just tossing aside the crown jewel of the country's cultural treasure trove.
Well, at that point in time, all the racial violence was not directed at the Jews.
Exactly.
So they would have been
Like they wouldn't even have recognized it. Yeah, there was no, exactly. There was no Bosnian War equivalent of General Fortner striding in to be like, give me all your best Judaica. I mean, and for the sad reason that there isn't much of a Jewish community there anymore after World War II.
Hardly any.
So at that point it was taken to a bank vault where it did, it basically wrote out the siege of Sarajevo in safety. There were rumors that it had been sold to bankroll the war. So in 1995, to great aplomb, it was brought out for a big kind of government seder. And the seder was performed from, see, we didn't sell the Sarajevo Haggadah.
Oh, well, that's cool.
And eventually international funding was brought together to give it the nice climate-controlled place where, because it was off display for decades, the nice climate-controlled room where it now sits when the Bosnian National Museum is not having money troubles.
And has there been any attempt to, I mean, I guess repatriate isn't the word, but to patriate it to Israel or to claim it on behalf of Israel?
Here's where Israel comes into the story. And no, to answer your question, I'm not aware of any sense that it you know, the state of Israel has ever asked for it. Because a lot of these Jewish treasures are still in the, I don't know if there is much of an idea that, well, now we have a homeland, we need to get all the stuff back the way everybody wants their colonizers stuff back, you know?
Oh, I believe that is a thread among some people.
I'm sure there is a part of the political spectrum, yeah. But in the arts community, I don't actually know.
I mean, in particular,
maybe they're happy to have this stuff in its original homes all over, you know, Europe or wherever.
All the stuff that's in salt mines and in vaults in Switzerland, I think they're hoping.
Well, that's a little different.
Repatriated to someone.
That stuff's a little different. But when Geraldine Brooks investigated this story in 2007, she found that, you know, this idea that that Dervish Korkut had hidden this priceless Jewish codex was actually a footnote in the family lore of World War II, because what they remember is the story of Mira Popo, a young Jewish girl living in Sarajevo in the early 40s, who, when the Nazis came in and began ethnic cleansing in Sarajevo, she, you know, at one point, you know, it's just like anywhere else. The rules get worse, the ghettos get worse, the privileges get less, the restrictions increase. And finally, one day, it's like everybody show up at the Jewish community center at such and such a time. And Mira Popo thinks correctly, oh, this is it. And she doesn't go. And when she gets to there to case the joint, she finds out it is, in fact, a roundup. And people are getting shipped out of Sarajevo. She sneaks in a window in the back of the community center and finds some of her relatives and tries to urge them to leave. And they're like, no, it's too late. We're not going to leave our families. So, you know, mourning, she climbs back out through the JCC window and heads to the hills. She's already kind of a socialist, young socialist Zionist, which was a thing you could be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
that's still a thing you can be.
That's what the militant young Jews were in the 30s. You know, you were a utopian socialist Zionist.
Oh, well, this is the problem. Right now, if you're a Zionist, you don't get to be a...
You're probably not a very good socialist.
Yeah, socialist.
And vice versa.
And split apart.
So she joins Tito's partisans
up in
the hills.
Run to the hills.
I guess at the time, there's kind of a complicated anti-Nazi movement because there's Tito's socialist partisans out lobbing bricks, but there's also a royalist movement that wants to put, you know, Peter II or whoever back on the throne of Yugoslavia.
Listen, I don't want to keep referring to Force 10 from Navarone, but it really is the...
you cannot understand the story, apparently.
It's the Lawrence of Arabia of World War II Bosnian.
So everything I'm...
politics.
Everything I'm mansplaining to you, you already know from Force 10 from Navarone.
Basically, if you watch Force 10 from Navarone, you'll understand this story. I mean, they're trying to blow up a dam, but it's the same.
If I've seen other Carl Weathers movies, will it help at all?
No. This should be your starting point.
So for a time, the royalists and the partisans kind of have a common enemy in the Nazis, and they make nice. And she spends the war as a muleteer, a donkey driver.
Yeah, donkey driver.
And a medic up there when the wounded come back. And she's a valued member of Tito's forces, but... things start to not go well for the partisans. The infighting with the royalists gets bad, and Tito can't even feed these guys anymore. And a bunch of these people get mustered out in 1942. Well, you're on your own now.
That seems early.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying Tito is a great counter-revolutionary. Tito's problematic. I think we can agree. So a bunch of these
he made the trains run on time.
Did he? A bunch of these, really, in Yugoslavia? I'm skeptical. So a bunch of these people get mustered out and are just left in the woods with nothing to protect them from the Nazis, no border to run to even. And a lot of them are young Jewish kids, and a lot of them are socialist Zionists like Mira. And so there's terrible stories of, you know, them just staying one step ahead of the dogs or not. She gets back to Sarajevo ahead of whatever Nazi patrols are after her unit. But it's a changed city, a city Onen Juden now, I guess, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Her dad was a custodian at some government building, and she happens to be sitting outside his office not knowing where to go. And she sees the porter that her dad used to know. And he recognized her, and he's like, oh,
he's
no.
Mayor of the town.
What? No, he's still the porter, but he's like, oh, no, you cannot be in Nazi Sarajevo, honey. Like, this is a bad—I don't know how you got back here, but this is a bad scene. And she's like, where do I go? And he thinks for a minute, and he says, well, you know what's next door? Is the Bosnian National Museum. Give me a second. And he goes next door and finds Dervish Korkut. I assume this guy's Muslim. Finds Dervish Korkut, you know, community leader, and says, there's a Jewish girl here. What do I do? And Korkut says, all right, let's figure this out. And so just as he had brought the Haggadah home to his family months earlier, he brings the girl home and says, honey, let me introduce you to our new veiled servant, Amira. This is a Jew hiding trick available if you're Muslim.
Right.
You can put a veil, you know, a chador-like veil over the refugee you're hiding. And say, this is our cousin from the country. She serves tea now.
Right. And you can't look under the veil for obvious reasons.
Right. Like, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
It could be anybody under there.
So for 4 months, they keep Amira, not, you know, Mira becomes Amira in their home. And eventually, I think they find a safer place out in Dalmatia where the Nazis don't have much of a presence. You know, they send her out to the coast.
Yeah.
And she successfully rides out the war there. So Dervish Korkut not only saved the Haggadah, but he saved this young Zionist Nazi hater girl. Now, after the war, Korkut fell out of fashion with the Tito government. Oh, you know why? For museum reasons. Tito's, of course, bulldozing all these amazing old historical parts of town to build
in order to unite the Slavs.
Right. He's getting rid of anything regional, and he just wants to build ugly Soviet brutalist buildings everywhere.
When I do my episode of beautiful Soviet brutalist,
you keep promising
statuary.
So he becomes a cultural enemy of the regime by becoming a preservationist, basically. He becomes a NIMBY, and Tito does not like NIMBYs, and so he faces a show trial, and a lot of his friends say, hey, Mira, you got to come testify, right? Like, it'll, if we see that this guy stood up to the Nazis, it'll be good for his case. And at the time, she's married to a guy who says, oh no, you are not going in front of Tito's show trial. And so she doesn't, and her husband dies a couple years later, and she just spends decades racked with guilt that this guy saved her life.
But she has bona fides with Tito because she, what, presumably fought alongside him.
Yeah, she was ready to testify.
Yeah.
And her cowardly husband is like, no, 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 no. You're not going to defend this guy. Like, he's going to go to the, whatever the Serbo-Croatian word for gulag is, or firing squad.
Cowardly husbands!
He's the true villain here. But, you know, he dies of some
cowardly husband disease.
Or stroke or something, a couple years later. And she winds up, one of her kids winds up in Israel. And so she's, by the 1970s, she's on a kibbutz, happily working a kibbutz in Israel with her two sons. And thinking all...
That's what they want you to think, that they were happily working in those kibbutzes. That's what all the pictures
said. You don't think it's so rosy?
I don't know.
They've all got the kerchiefs.
I don't know. I've worked on a farm.
It looks great.
It's hot there in the summer.
And I think this whole time she assumes that... now, in the 90s, during the breakup of Yugoslavia, when Sarajevo is under siege, Israel offers temporary shelter to Bosnian refugees. And so Mira somehow runs across somebody from home who has an old news clipping showing that a Korkut was still alive.
Whoa.
You know, and commemorating all the good deeds he did. But wait,
still alive and still in jail?
In the 90s. Well, she doesn't know. She reconnects with him. Oh no, he had died. He had died of elderly causes in 69. She is able to reconnect with his widow And so at 72 years old, she gets the story of how he actually, you know, he spent, I don't know, 6 years. He spent the better part of a decade in Tito's prison and then gets out, not with his full citizenship restored, but he's able to live out a life. He eventually has a kid, a daughter named La Mia. And Mira, feeling bad about not having stood up for him in the late 40s, whenever the show trial was. And by the way, the family reassures her it wouldn't have mattered. The verdict was a done deal. You should not have been torturing yourself for decades about this. She decides to write down, she writes in a letter exactly what the story was and what he did, and sends it to Yad Vashem.
The
Holocaust Memorial in Israel. Because, you know, they've got this whole commission of
the righteous.
Yeah, the designation of the righteous. You know, who were the friends of the Jews who actually helped when the chips were down. And as a result, a diplomat calls her up to say, yeah, you and Dervish have been named righteous among nations. You know, your names are going to be inscribed in that Yad Vashem garden. There was a big ceremony at the, they invited Korkut's widow to come. She couldn't come to Israel to see the, you know, her name on the memorial next to the Schindler tree and the Raoul Wallenberg tree and whatever. But she can go to Paris, so a memorial is held there. And Mira is able to reunite with her benefactor's widow. Now, if we jump ahead, there's like an interesting footnote to this story. In 1999, the Korkut's daughter, the daughter of his old age, La Mia, had heard the story of Mirapopa many times. And after the Bosnian War, they had made what turned out to be the ill-advised move. The La Mia Korkut had made and her family had made the ill-advised move to go to Kosovo.
Oh dear!
And so, just as the Bosnian War wraps up, she's living in Pristina, Kosovo, and suddenly all the ethnic cleansing starts again there, and she's in trouble. She tries to get, she winds up in a refugee camp at the border, and it's awful. And so she just takes off in the dead of night, is able to hoodwink a border guard into letting her into Macedonia. But suddenly she's got no place to go. And she starts reaching out to fellow Bosnian refugee friends all over Europe. And nobody can shelter her. Yeah, nobody's able to find a place for her to go via diplomatic means. But one thing she has, and so she's in Skopje, the capital of Macedonia, but one thing she does have is her dad's certificate from the Yad Vashem garden saying designation of the righteous, whatever the name of the status is. And so a family member who had fled to, I think, Sweden or someplace had said, hey, why don't you try, go to the Jewish community in Skopje and see if they'll help you. So she goes to the synagogue and shows them the photocopy of Mirapopo's letter and the certificate, you know, which includes the famous, whoever saves one life, it is as if he has saved an entire world or whatever. And the Macedonian Jews there are, you know, receiving this Muslim woman, are delighted that they have this chance to repay a 40, 50-year-old debt.
It's very moving.
Yeah, it's a great story. And so they just begin lobbying immediately, trying to figure out, you know, what can we do? How can we save her? Can we get her to Israel? And within 4 days, she and her husband are on a plane to Tel Aviv. The kids are coming a couple days later. And this has become a big media circus in Israel. The media is there. Netanyahu's there. The politicians have all found out, you know, because it's a
heartwarming story of a Muslim.
It's an irresistible story of, you know,
being saved by the Jews.
Yeah. And, you know, a Muslim who saved a Jew improbably 50 years ago, now, you know, Israel gets the chance to repay.
And are you going to tell me that this precipitated peace in the Middle East and all of the Palestinians rallied around this act of generosity and all the war was over?
In the New Yorker story, which I'm relying on heavily here, the Korkut's daughter actually seems a little bit put off to become a press conference. You know, she's just trying to get out of Macedonia alive, and suddenly Netanyahu's there saying, we are closing a great circle in the state of Israel. And reporters are yelling at her, you know, aren't you happy to be here? You know, and she's like, well, no, I'm having a really bad week, actually. You know, I'm a refugee. And then suddenly she hears Serbo-Croatian for the, you know, she hears her home language. And then Mira Papo's son, Davor, you know, who had brought his mom to the kibbutz in the 70s, you know, comes out of the crowd and gives her a big hug. And she actually does feel a little bit at home. So the story of the Sarajevo Haggadah, you know, and its rescue from the Nazis and then later during the Bosnian Civil War has its own echo in a human life and a exchange of mitzvahs, I guess.
Well, actually, Ken, that actually dovetails with one of the plot twists in Forced In from Navarre.
No, it does not. I don't believe that for a second.
And that concludes the Sarajevo Haggadah, entry 1102.EX1243, certificate number 48606, in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick, although I've been permanently banned from Twitter, so you can only find me on Instagram and Facebook. Woohoo!
There will be a museum of your tweets someday.
Jeez, hope not. There already is. It's in the angry, angry tweets of others. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and please do. We love reading your emails, or Mindy does. You can hang out with other futurelings on Facebook and other social media sites by searching for futurelings. You can send us real mail, actual mail, which very shortly will be the only true media, because all other media will be faked by ChatGPT and AI image and video fakery, so that you won't be able to depend on anything you see or read or experience that isn't sent to you in the actual mail and you can hold it in your hands. And even then, it's probably a lie.
Like, I had never thought about this, but, you know, somebody listening to this in 500 years will just assume this is an AI-generated piece of content.
You and me. How do we demonstrate our humanity and make it so that no AI could possibly generate our level of wit and banter?
Maybe by making noises like these?
Well, the thing is, it's all of our weird, like, I mean, when I made the Spinal Tap reference, you made the sound of the metal detector.
On Derek Smalls, the wand on Derek Smalls.
No AI could ever make that that degree of complicated reference. Now, I'm thinking only 1% of our listeners actually got the reference, but that's, I think, going to be the proof that you're never going to be able to make a reference inside of a reference using ChatGPT.
I mean, probably nobody even understood what we were doing until you said it.
Oh, should I not have unmasked your gag? Because there is that 1% that are like, oh, I was the only one that got it. Now you explained it.
I think it's okay.
Not fun
anymore.
They
got to enjoy being the only one for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Why should a podcast give you lasting pleasure? It should give you 20 minutes of pleasure tops.
There you go. There you go. That's a thing that ChatGPT will never understand either.
Exactly.
So you just opened a piece of mail, their ChatGPT-generated co-host. What is in the envelope?
Beep, boop, beep. We got a graduation announcement from Ella.
Hey, congratulations, Ella.
Ella's going to FSU in the fall. I don't know why Ella's parents sent
Florida
us
State.
A graduation announcement, but... well done. We have a picture of Ella on a steamer trunk.
Let me see.
Next to the number 23, possibly with a...
Number 23? Is she a...
is that a snake around her neck? No, I don't think so.
Like a Chicago...
Oh, it's a cat.
...basketball fan?
Yeah, exactly. No, class of 23, John.
Oh, I see.
All the kids had to sit on that steamer trunk.
Look at you, Ella. Is she playing a saxophone? What is that?
It's a cat.
Oh, it's a cat.
It took me a second.
You know,
I thought it was a snake. You thought it was a saxophone.
Every cat looks like a saxophone to me.
Schrodinger's saxophone.
And she's wearing Doc Martens or maybe those aren't Fluvogs, are they? Nobody knows what Fluvogs are.
I assumed
are,
they anymore. Were Doc. They were
Docs.
Martins, but we also got a copy of this
Have
book.
You noticed we didn't turn the lights on today? We're kind of just sitting here
It's a
bathed in daylight.
It's an audio medium. Nobody cares if the lights are on. Could you tell listeners? Could you tell that this was Omnibus After Dark?
Yeah, we were sitting in the dark.
We also got a copy of Matt Parker's book Humble Pie about real world math mistakes. The funny thing is, didn't we get like an advance copy of this book?
I think so. Humble Pie, P-I, Pie.
Yes. When math goes wrong in the real world. And I read it and I enjoyed it. Apparently I didn't blurb it because there's no blurb of me here. But
or maybe you did and it didn't pass muster.
Yeah, maybe my blurb was not as good as Adam Savage's. this was the inaugural selection of the Adam Savage Book Club.
What's your Erdős number? We established that you don't have one. That's probably why your blurb isn't on there.
Yeah, I think the one thing I co-authored with somebody with an Erdős number is not a
math paper.
It's not an academic math paper. Yeah. And I will never write an academic math paper.
We don't know. We don't know. It's possible.
Should I try to get something? Should I try to co-author something just to get it in the...
You don't want to do that, but we have enough mathematicians listening to the show that there's got to be one who can think of a way, not a specious way, but an actual way that you and I can become co-authors.
Yeah. Do you want somebody like me who was barely keeping up with math until I got to differential equations and then I couldn't even do that anymore?
The thing about me is I'm pretty convinced that I'm way past math into like math.
I love
you know
this,
what I mean?
I love this math. Idea that, yeah, I bet I'm really good
I'm
at math.
I'm really good at big math.
And is that does that explain your failures to do small m math?
Yeah, because big math is so far past math that it comes around the other side. It's like if you get so conservative, you become a liberal.
Yeah.
You get so big, the math gets so big that it starts treading on territory that I'm very comfortable.
What are some of the numbers you have access to that you think ordinary mathematicians don't even
know? See, that's the thing. I'm in math beyond numbers.
Oh, you don't even have numbers?
No.
See, that would have been easier
for
me if my math teachers had had math without numbers.
You have to get there, though. You have to get there by coming at it through the back door or front door, depending.
Interesting. Well, whoever sent us this copy of Matt Parker's book, thank you. I enjoyed it, and now I'll make John read it.
Yeah, I'll keep it in the bathroom and read a little bit at a time. Futurelings, if you want to send us things, I told you already to send it to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155, but I'm going to tell you again. And finally, please support the show. Your generous contributions and your participation on our Patreon site led to us doing this show. This was a Patreon bonus content show. You go to patreon.com. And if you're not already signed up to use Patreon, it's very simple to do. And then you just pledge a monthly amount from $1 to $100 million.
And no matter which tier you give at, you will immediately have access to 44 old, well, new to you, Omnibus Addenda shows, which answer the question, what would Omnibus be like with even less preparation and content?
If you want to give us 100 million Lebanese pounds...
Is this a number that only your math has? 100 million Lebanese pounds?
At the current exchange rate, 100 million Lebanese pounds, and this is the official exchange rate, is $6,555.
That would be a nice bequest.
But on the black market, 100 million Lebanese pounds... is let's see, black market, that would be, well, right now a Lebanese pound is 94,000 Lebanese pounds equals $1, so 100 million Lebanese pounds divided by 94,000.
I lost the zeros. About $1,000. Is it less than what you said before?
Well, let's see. You're good at math.
Adam
You're
Savage.
Good at old
Adam
number
Savage
math.
Already knows.
By
if you had just joined the Adam Savage Book Club, John.
94. Don't distract me. It's hard for me to write.
6, 21,
no,
4.
No, it's about, you're right. You're right. It was about $1,063. So 100 million Lebanese pounds, because we only accept the black market rate here, not the official rate. The black market rate is 1/6. Value.
That would be a nice yearly donation. Give us 100 million Lebanese pounds a year.
Although they're probably devaluating at a rate so that by the end of the year, it'll only be $100. But that's also a great donation to our Patreon.
It definitely would put you at the tier of being able to select a show topic like Valerie did. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.